Welcome back to Cardnock Life. This is your Black Monday episode, which is the Monday that comes after... No, it was Cyber Monday. Cyber Monday. How about that?
Yes, Cyber Monday episode. This is just another Drunken Storm Monday episode, but I decided not to drink and play Storm before the podcast.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I've recently, every Monday, I've been pouring some Crown and Cokes or Arnold Palmer's, whatever I happen to have on the mix, and I've been playing Vintage Storm, the drinking game.
All right, and that continues tonight, huh?
I recently discovered Dying Light, and that game is insanely good.
What's that?
So, I don't know. It's a maybe.
Is it a card game?
No, it's a video game on Steam.
Oh,
it's like a parkour action zombie apocalypse game.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Well, yeah, there's a lot going on in that game.
I feel a tangent coming on. I can try to suppress it, but we just...
I'm not going to tangent at all, dude. I'm saying that it might be the object of my obsession instead of Drunken Storm Monday.
Okay, well, disclaimer, this podcast is going to be released on a Tuesday, so Drunken Storm Monday would have already happened or not happened by the time you're listening to it. So,
lame, dude. We can start recording on Sunday so people can know that Drunken Storm Monday is coming.
Yeah, man, we can be 7 days early to promote the next week, so maybe it'll happen the following Monday. So stay tuned.
Yeah, Drunken Storm Monday. Back to normal on next Monday. Perfect.
Speaking of video games, I'm pretty psyched for the new Final Fantasy that comes out tomorrow, or today, if you listen to this on a Tuesday.
Yeah, rest in peace, your social life.
That's right, yep. Yeah. All right, man, but let's talk Magic, because that's what we're here for.
That is what we're here for, yeah, I agree.
There haven't been any events lately that we can really cover in terms of, results and things, because of Thanksgiving weekend.
I was saying, that's because we consumed delicious, delicious turkey.
That's right, it was great.
Yeah.
And honestly, I didn't get to play as much Magic as I have been recently, but this weekend coming up is the regional PPTQ, or excuse me, the regional PTQ.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be playing in the modern regionals on Sunday. So I've been trying to prepare for that quite a bit than I normally would because I'd like to go to Ireland. Yep.
My question, have you locked in a deck?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
What are you playing?
I'm going to play Grixis Delver. But I've played a lot of different decks in the prep. What's that?
I was curious because I saw you playing Green White Tron earlier this week, and so
yeah.
I wasn't sure if that was like a Modo deck you were playing or if that was like something you were debating playing in the RPG.
I would consider playing it. I don't have enough of the cards to really put it together, but honestly, the reason I've been jamming that all week is because it's like I feel like it's kind of the biggest threat to Grixis Delver right now. That's a really tough matchup for me, so I want to understand the deck from a play perspective and kind of know what things can really shut it down. So I'm running I may be running Blood Moons in my sideboard. I'm kind of considering not doing that, but with the kind of emergence of this green-white Tron, thanks to Tom Ross, I feel like I kind of have to have some contingency plan for these Tron decks.
Do you think that the multi-fulminator image Akolagon Span package is good?
I don't like that at all. I think it's just too slow. It's just, if anything, I would go like Crumble to Dust, and I know that's also slow, but I've tried the Fulminator Mage package before, and I don't know. It's not my jam. I've cut down to one Kolaghan's Command in the deck, too. I think it's like one of the weakest cards in the deck right now. I want to be on like one and two mana spells if I can.
You make me so sad.
I know. I love Kolaghan's Command, but in the way I'm playing the deck right now, I can't run too many.
So sad.
Yeah. And honestly, I haven't been seeing a lot of Affinity, and maybe it's just kind of the online meta. We'll talk about that in a little bit, but I think maybe that would skew my decision a little bit. But I guess what I want to talk about is kind of like competitive level tournament stuff and prep, and specifically how MTGO factors into that. This is something that's kind of new to me. We haven't always had a PC. I've been a Mac person for the longest time, and you know, my wife and I got a PC probably year or two ago. So that's changed a lot of how that all looks because MTGO gives you such an edge in practicing and preparing and just like building your skill set for that kind of play. And there are lots of reasons why that's true.
Kind of, but yeah, I agree with you.
So my major pros here, the biggest benefit from this, I'd say one of the most obvious is more reps. The fact that you can log in and you can play like tournament level Magic in like League at any time, and you can do that without the downtime in between rounds, means a lot. I've thought about the amount of games I'm able to play like in an FNM. And if you think about it, you go four rounds, you play four people. And the amount of time you spend at an FNM, which you can only do once a week, you could play seven matches on Moto or more.
So let me say it this way.
Yeah, what?
I recently undertook, like, we were, like, some of my friends suggested a Narset deck. This is kind of on the Moto tangent. A Narset deck, and they were like, all right, well, we need to test this. So I just started streaming. I was like, give me the deck list. I like to play Narset. I want to play this deck. I want to stream it. I played 75 matches in 2 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah, that's insane. I basically played 5 GPs in 2 weeks.
Yeah. And that, you know, Daryl, that, like, 75 matches sounds like a lot. When you put it as 5 GPs... that sounds like a lot less, but I think it kind of speaks to the fact that GPs are freaking long. You've got to, like, persevere. You've got to, like, you've got to be able to win 11 of your games, or 11 of your matches, excuse me.
13. 13? 13
for top 8?
Yeah, for top 8.
Okay, sure.
Yeah.
That's a lot of playing. I mean, that's going to what, four FNMs? Worth of games there, games and matches. That's a lot of
time. That's a lot more than four FNMs. The number of FNMs. So if you look at it, in 2 weeks, I played 75 matches. Mm-hmm. Matches. So that's two game sets. So I played, you figure if you go five rounds in FNM, that's 15 FNMs. That's literally 4 months of FNMs.
I'm talking about comparing the length of a GP to any kind of smaller level tournament.
Oh, yeah.
I guess the point I'm trying to make with that is that you can only get so much preparation done playing four rounds a week.
Yeah.
When you're preparing for an event that is 15, 16 rounds at, you know, tops.
Yep. So I will say that, you know, there's a con to that more reps thing is that some people, and I kind of did it at the very beginning, I was much more prone to this because I was just trying to play games, but I wasn't critical with why my results, to say, okay, why did I lose these games? Like, what caused me to not win this game? And was it because I misplayed or my opponent drew very well? Mm-hmm. And so the first like 10 or so matches, I wasn't doing that. And that was causing me problems. And so because you can just turn around matches so quickly, if you don't, you know, actively make yourself stop and do some match decompression and understand why you're losing games, you're going to lose games. You're going to lose games in the big portion and where you actually want to win. And it's basically like those games didn't even happen because you learned nothing from them.
Right. Yeah, I mean, so it sounds like you've kind of mined a lot of data about your deck in specific matchups and things like that. And that data really isn't as valuable to you unless you have, you know, like massive amounts of it. You know, like you can lose a game against your best matchup and think it's a bad matchup. If you've only got one game in your sample, you know, there's a possibility that you just drew bad, that deck drew well, and it turns out that actually, you know, that's a good matchup. You want to play that one as much as possible.
Yeah, and I think if you want me to link it, I got a spreadsheet with a bunch of data in it.
Yeah, you know, share it. Absolutely, if you're willing.
Yeah, I'll share it. This is sort of my, this is the first, like, not even hardcore testing for an event. I just did some hardcore testing. And, like, it turns out the deck I was playing is, like, 17-8 against, like, the top 8-10 decks on Modo, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you remove two decks from that equation, the deck is 16-3 in matches.
Wow.
I think I'm like one in five against Dredge and like one in four against Tron. But the rest of the meta, I'm 16-2 or something dumb like that. Yeah. Like I've just gotten my head kicked in by Tron and Dredge.
Yeah, that's a little frightening though.
Yeah. And then I haven't lost a game to Jund, Infect, Affinity, Boggles, Suicide Blue, Suicide Zoo. Haven't lost a game to any of those decks.
Yeah.
So it's just like, well, if you really think, if like Dredge is actually 10% of the meta and Tron is 6% of the meta, you might leave this game on the this deck on the shelf unless, you know, you're trying to just beat like all those fair creature decks. In which case, you might just be able to play this deck and say, I'm going to just accept my game one losses to Dredge and Tron.
So, yeah.
I think that's really hard for Modern right now, is that, you know, there are decks like that. There are matchups like that to where it's just like you're literally taking that game one loss. And so it's really hard to play a deck that could take a game one loss to 8% of the meta because, you know, 8% of the meta in a big tournament like the one you're going to, that's one match.
Right, absolutely. And you've got to be able to do two things when you go to a big event like that. One of them is run hot, right? No matter how well you play, you could draw bad. You could just get mana screwed. The luck could just not be on your side. You could not win, and that's beyond your control. But the other thing is you've got to luck out in your matchups too. And so beyond just drawing well and not, you know, getting totally mana screwed, you've got to hope that you just don't play your bad matchup three rounds in a row in the first three rounds. But it happens. You know, you could see it in the first round and put you on tilt.
Sure, absolutely.
But that said, I think you really have to consider those things. And if you're telling me that Dredge is a terrible matchup for your deck, that would probably be a deciding factor in whether or not I'm going to play that deck at an event like that.
Absolutely.
Now, the conversation we had last week, we talked a little bit about increasing the sideboard size to 20, and I know basically everyone hated that idea, but I think I basically brought it up to just kind of consider the fact that would having more options in the sideboard help you to edge some of the really, really bad matchups? But that said, the alternative to that is just focusing more of your 15 options to one of your bad matchups, which would take away from, you know, some of your mediocre matchups and make those worse for you. So a lot of decision-making,
And that's literally what it is. If I had another five cards in my sideboard, I'd play, like, two more Nihil Spell Bombs and, like, a Memricide and a couple more Ghost Quarry. I would just play five cards to beat those two decks.
Yeah. Those are cards that are great examples of cards that just don't make the cut for me. They're just outside of those 15. Like, if I had 20 options, I'd play a whole heck of a lot more Nihil Spell Bomb.
Another card that's kind of looked that way for me is Rune Halo, especially in playing white decks. Rune Halo is a fantastic card.
Yeah.
But it's like card number 16, card number 17, card number 19, I consider. Like, it just, after you slot in things that you just don't want to leave home without, you know, you don't want to leave without a disenchant and get caught by an artifact or affinity. You don't want to leave home without a purge, you know, without a negate. Without a discard spell or without a surgical, whatever, you know, you're a little bit of graveyard hate. Once you kind of line up all the things you don't want to leave home without, you really just have like seven slots. And it's so hard to like, you know, because Rune Halo is like card number 8 or 9 on that list of, you know, seven slots.
Yeah, man. And you know, the other thing is picking the less optimal option for a certain matchup because it has more applications than other matchups. I think a good example of that is Ravenous Trap. You see a lot of Ravenous Trap. That card is like literally like only good in situations where you're playing against Dredge to trigger that trap cost. And yeah, there's some other corner cases. But I would never run Ravenous Trap over, you know, Relic of Progenitus or Tormod's Crypt or whatever the other option is, because those cards have upside against even decks like Jund, any decks that are running like Tarmogoyf or Lingering Souls, any decks that have Snapcaster Mage.
There's one instant that I would run Ravenous Trap over one of those other cards, and that's if I'm playing Card Mystical Teachings.
If you're playing Mystical Teachings? Well, you can dial Spell Bomb as that option, you know, because you don't target your own graveyard.
No, so Mystical Teachings tutors an instant out of your deck.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, gotcha.
You can trigger the trap from inside your deck by Teachings for Trap them when they trigger it.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
So, you can hide it. Okay. But if you're not playing Mystical Teachings, Ravenous Trap, I think, has no upside.
I thought you were considering the Nombo with the flashback. I guess that's another factor.
No, that's not it. That would be great. But that's the only factor. If you can hide your graveyard inside your deck and go get it on command, then I would
Teachings Trap would be a fun deck. You could just... you could run all of them, man. You could do the Summoning Trap and, like, Emrakul.
I mean, you could just play Esper Teachings and just have, like, Esper Charm and Negate and stuff like that. But that's bad. Don't do that. That's bad. I tried.
There are, like, Ricochet, Trap. There's fun stuff, man.
All these are bad. Corey, just walk away from the traps.
Okay, let's tangent a little bit on this. I want to bring it back home in a second. But one of the cards that I considered, sure. I've been playing a lot of Grixis. I considered a lot of different sideboard options as kind of like a one-of, because there are things that, you know, you can board into your deck that are just total blowouts because they'll never see them coming. This one's not so much the case, but I kind of have been experimenting with a card like Cedroxus Spectre in the Grixis Delver type of shell against decks like Jund, for example, that are like Liliana-ing my, you know, make me discard a card. I want to honor the Cedroxus Spectre and just go to the dome when I'm on like the burn the face plan.
Or just kill the Liliana, like, yeah. You know, they eat a Castigar and they make you discard the Cedroxus Spectre.
You know what that card is? I'll just explain it for everyone that doesn't know, but it's a,
yeah, it's blue, black, red. It's Grixis for a 3-2 flyer that makes them discard a card when it hits them with Unearth.
Yeah.
One in a black for the Unearth?
One in a black for the Unearth, which is the best part. So it's kind of like a Blightning on the graveyard in a way.
Yeah, I'm the best. I'm so good at this.
And when you're running like Thought Scars and stuff, you Thought Scar and on turn, you can Unearth it on your turn. But, you know, it's been kind of lackluster. That's another one of those ones that's kind of outside of my 15 because it's just like, that's it's like spicy. Too cute and doesn't solve a lot of my bad matchups in that deck.
So I have a question because I just thought of this.
Yeah.
Are you on the burn the face plan against Tron usually?
Against Tron, I'm on the Well, you know, honestly, I, like, have to board out everything that's bad against it, and then I, like, run out of, like, good stuff to put in a lot of cases. I'm on the, like, just aggro, like, get my Tassigars down and, like, just start beating with Tassigar. And I play, like, Karn Squalls and stuff just for, like, damage and, like, Karn control.
Because I know you said that's a really tough matchup for you.
Yeah.
And this is a card that I'm going to tell you that's, like, you can also bring in that is, like, that can be a longer game card against decks like Jund and Abzan.
Okay, what's that?
Dredge, Anathemancer.
Oh, Anathemancer. It's flashback 7, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which is a little steep for my deck. Is running 19 lands, but you know, on the front side,
think,
it's okay.
I don't think you're not gonna flashback it against Tron. Really, it's just gonna be like a Lava Spike or a Flame Rift or whatever. It's gonna be three or four damage to their face.
Yeah. What is it? Like 3-2.
Yeah, it's a 2/2 zombie wizard. For one red black on the front end. So it's just like a 3-mana finisher. Like you play Tassigar and you're like attacking them and you're like, all right, I play Anathemancer. I can kill that card after you exile my Tassigar, or I can hit you for 4 and like finish the game, like whatever you need out of that.
Yeah, and you can also command it back too.
You do play against like Dunn and things like that where you do flood out. You can put all your lands into play and Anathemancer your opponent.
Yeah, that's legit. I like that. That's another one of those ones that just, it seems good, but it's like, it gets booted out by the cards that I have to include in my 15, you know?
Yeah, I think it's the same discussion I was having. You know, you don't want to leave one without a disenchant and a purge. So, you know, for you, you don't have, like, leave without a Kolaghan's Command and a dispel and a negate.
right.
A surgical and all these various different things. So it's kind of frustrating, but.
So, long story short, all the reps that you get on Moto can really help to tighten up your sideboard, but also tighten up your sideboard to, you know, kind of support the way that you play the deck. Because I think that's different for a lot of people, and there are a lot of ways that, you know, people utilize cards in different fashions that, you know, like make certain strategies more beatable for you personally.
I agree.
For example, you know, if you have like, there are lots of different perspectives in like a deck that's heavy on like shock lands versus like a burn deck. You know, like if you can manage to like fetch all your basics and not really like deal a lot of damage to yourself on your shock fetch plan, you don't have to pack as much of the life gain. If you can control, you know, like with cards like Dispel and things like that against the burn deck, you don't really have to be heavy on the like, oh my gosh, like I've got to have like Vampiric Link to even like have a chance in this matchup. So,
you're willing to take a tempo loss to sequence your spells, you know? You know, turn one, I'm always going to take nothing because I'm just going to put this into play tapped to play 2-1 drops on turn 2.
Right, exactly. My theory against burn with Delver, for example, I want to get them into the top deck mode where I've got more cards in hand. You know, I want to have control cards in hand. I want to be drawing Snapcasters to negate like any burn they draw off the top of the deck. In that case, I don't care what life I'm at. If I'm at 1 life, I can win the game as long as I've got the right cards in my hand and they're in top deck mode. So I just got to I've got to outlast that and get to that point in the game, and then it's GG. Then it's game over. And I guess that's the case with Life Gain too, but that's not the way that I get there, you know? You just gotta, be able to decide which ones, which spells you can take to the dome in that case. Anyways, another positive for Moto, and I think this is the biggest one for me personally, is really getting to understand the rules. And I've got an example for you. Every time a card gets played and every time a trigger occurs in Moto, it gets acknowledged by the game. And you have to click OK unless you F6 through the turn and, you know, you just pass priority the whole turn. Now, that is a huge difference maker for those that really aren't used to, you know, understanding those rules. And there are just so many intricacies in Magic. There really are. So here I am. I'm playing Tron. Like I said, I was playing a lot of Tron last week. I've got a bunch of mana, a shit ton of mana. I've got Tron on the board, and I've got Oblivion Stone on the board. Versus elves, versus mono green elves. Now, I feel Eclectic Company coming on, but all of his elves are tapped down, except for just enough mana to Eclectic Company. So I'm ready to like pop this thing at the end of turn, but I want to bait out that Eclectic Company first before I do. So he goes Eclectic Company when I pass priority, and Eclectic Company gets a Dwinin's Elite and an Azuri. And Dwinin's Elite is the card that's a 2/2 if you control an elf.
Makes an elf if you control an elf.
So effectively, he's getting three elves, one of them being an Azuri, one that can regenerate elves, out of
Does Eclectic Company. Does he have a Heritage Druid?
Yeah, he's got a Heritage Druid on the board.
Okay, so he breaks the stone in response to the trigger, because then he won't have three elves.
Exactly, and that's what I'm getting at. So the Dwinin's Elite comes out, and that's a trigger that happens. So in game of Paper Magic, and you're probably smarter than me if you're thinking, you know, this is something, of course I would know that. But it's not always apparent
to people. It's just because I'm used to, like, playing control in situations where, like, you know, your opponent, if they miss on their one-drop elf, they'll just roll a turn two Dwinin's Elite to play. Does it say another elf, or just, like,
Another elf.
Oh, okay, never mind. Then this doesn't work. Because, like, the way I had assumed Dwinin's Elite worked as a Magic card was just, like, if you controlled an elf when it came into play, they got a 1-1. So I would always just kill the Dwinin's Elite. Yeah.
Yeah, so it would always trigger if that was the case. It doesn't trigger.
And that's what I thought it did.
Okay.
So in my mind, not knowing how the card worked, shortcutted me into actually, like, understanding how to play around that specific situation.
Right.
Which is really bad.
That's an extremely specific situation. But just to slow down a little bit, let me just explain, you know, like, how this
works. Oh, yeah,
so Paper Magic, you would drop the card. I would just, you know, like, put the token on the table next to it as I cast it in a lot of cases. But that's not really how the game sees it. You know, it triggers when the elf comes into play and when Azuri comes into play. So at the time, he's only got two elves. He cannot Heritage Druid with two elves. So really what you've got to do is you've got to pop your Oblivion Stone and kill all the elves before that third trigger happens, which... The result is he's going to get an elf token, but that's a lot better than him being able to regenerate three of his elves with the Azuri and the Heritage Druid mana.
Did you fail the test?
You know, I did fail because I was just playing too fast. I didn't even consider that to be a possibility because out of a Eclectic Company, I thought I was in the clear. But he just happened to get the two perfect cards. I won the game. I won the game. Cool. I was fine.
Good.
But
that's good. I was just like, that sucks when you just missed the vote.
Yeah, well, that's one example of a case like that. But, you know, there are many more. Like, obviously, like, Oblivion Stone isn't the only one. Kozel Extra Turn or, like, Volcanic Fallout would be the same sort of, you know, like, play in that situation. But there are times where, you know, like, especially, like, you're dealing, like, blue Tron, mono blue Tron. There's a lot of tricky triggers that have to go on with that deck in terms of, like, untap before you draw. You have to put your Mindslaver on top of your deck. And, you know, that's kind of like that's a pretty intuitive one. But there are a lot of, like, kind of awkward ways to sort of use the stack in Moto that you don't always become comfortable with unless you do it a lot online.
Correct.
And it's easy to make those shortcuts in paper, and it doesn't really benefit you where you can, you know, use the rules to your advantage. And if you really understand them, you get an edge. You get a huge edge in games. So that's the other case. More reps and then really developing a better understanding of the rules and acknowledging your triggers. Now, let's just cover the cons a little bit here, because I think there are certainly some cons to acknowledge with the program. Clearly, like, all of the errors are frustrating, right? All the, like, the problems and bugs aside, I think the biggest thing with this one is when you're first getting into the program, in first using Modo, you make so many mistakes operating the program that cause you to lose the games where it wouldn't happen in paper. Maybe you're running out of time and you shortcut and you just pass a trigger that you would have wanted to stop on because, you know, you had a response to it. You didn't even consider that play, but had you thought of it, you would have gone F6 through the turn and you just missed an opportunity to react to something.
Many times. Yeah, so many times.
Learning it, you're going to have a lot of those situations where you lose the game a lot when you just... You know, it's because you just made a misclick. Maybe your thing bugged out for a second, and you double clicked okay, and it ended up passing through two steps on your turn. You didn't get to attack. It happens, right?
Yeah, or you hit F2 twice, which is really annoying.
Yeah. So when you lag, that happens a lot. I've passed turns. I've also concede game is dangerously close to yield until end of turn. That's happened to me before too.
Dude, why do you even do that? Just F6, my man.
Because my computer, you have to hit FN function F6 in order for it to work. And I like to just do it with one hand. I use my mouse and I just like sit away from it.
That's moi garbage, sir.
Yeah, I gotta get that fixed. But the other one, you can get beyond that, of course. But the other con is the difference in the meta, and there is a significant difference in the online meta for Magic Online versus paper. And one of those things is like consider decks like Abzan Company, where you have to click through all of your life gain triggers and your infinite combos. You can run out of time and just lose the game because you didn't do it fast enough. You can play Blue Charm. Yeah. You can try to Mindslaver your opponent into oblivion. If you take too long doing that, you lose the game. There's a chess timer in Magic Online that doesn't exist in paper.
Yeah, and Mindslaver is one of those cards that's unbelievably arduous to operate on Magic the Gathering Online.
Yeah.
Like, I was, like, playing Blue-White Tron for a while, and I casted, like, Emrakul the Promised End against my opponent, and I'm like, all right, I have a 13-13. I'm just going to kill them. It took me, like... It's been so long since I played Mindslaver that it took me like 2.5 minutes to figure out how to play my opponent's turn.
Yeah, it's tough. It really is. The best bet is just tap out and pass the turn. Unless you got some removal spell to take advantage of, don't get too cute.
I definitely tried to get way too cute. Yeah. Because they had a bunch of counter spells in their hand and a Wrath of God. So I was like, Wrath of God, counter it, counter your counter spell, counter that counter spell. And it was just like, I didn't hold control right, ended up killing my Emrakul and left him with a dispel, and it was awful.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, not only did I screw up what I knew I wanted to do, but it took me, like, 4 minutes to screw it up and kill my 13-13.
Right. So that's a factor, and I don't think that Abzan Company, like, the arduous trigger management is really the leading factor in that. But, cost is another factor. You know, people don't want to drop $40 on a digital copy of Tarmogoyf. They certainly don't want to drop $160 on a paper copy of Tarmogoyf, whatever the hell it costs now. But
you could buy 4 digital Tarmogoyfs.
Right. But yeah, there's certainly restrictions with the different different values in the digital cards.
There are certainly different cards that cost randomly more money.
Oh yeah, Gitaxian Probe is one of them. Yeah. Maybe it's a cheap, inexpensive card in paper too, but there are plenty of commons that just really, really are up there in price. Okay, so there's one thing now. We talked about pros and cons. There's one thing that I would consider both a pro and con, and I think this is a really interesting difference in the online metagame and the paper metagame, or really just the way that the game functions. That is the chess timer. And I think that, I'll tell you right now, I love the chess timer. I think it's great. Oh, every player starts the game with a certain amount of time. When priority is in their hands, that time ticks away. When they run out of time, they lose the game. Doesn't matter what match it is. Doesn't matter if they've won the first game. Or, excuse me, doesn't matter what game it is. It doesn't matter what the record is. Match is over, yeah.
I agree. Now, I've played many a game with Esper control decks and blue-white control decks. Or my opponent will have 4 minutes on the clock after game one, and I will have like 22 minutes just because I know how to play my deck and I'm like, I understand what I'm trying to do. And it's just comical to see something like that where like neither deck is particularly complicated, but because my opponent doesn't understand how to interact with my deck, or like there's too many priority points because I want to do something at, you know, every point in their turn, and they're like, oh my God, why so many? It's comical to see them, the clock differentials sometimes after matches are finished.
Oh, it's great. And that's something that you always got to keep your eye on, because if you know how to play it, you can win a game just by running them out of time. I've done it many, many times.
Yes.
And it's almost as big of a factor in a game as card advantage in your hand. If you're looking at the clock and they're down 3 minutes on you, that's like, I don't know how to equate that to like having an extra card in your hand, but your game plan can just be to stall, just to make it harder for them to win faster. You know?
So like there are oftentimes that I'm playing against like a combo opponent that their clock actually matters. Like if I'm playing against Storm and they have, you know, 19 minutes on their clock and they start storming off and they, you know, go through all the motions, fast to flames, go through all the motions, make a bunch of mana, you know, and they take, you know, 4 or 5 minutes on their combo turn, I'll make them play the whole turn out and stack all the grape shots and make it. I'll hit F6 and make them like go through each one of the grape shots and yield to it to like cause them to burn a bunch of their clock. And it feels really scummy to do because like normally when a Storm player starts doing that, they get to this like point of no return where it just doesn't matter what happens, they're not going to brick.
Mm-hmm.
But like on Moto, that point of no return can cost them the match because, you know, they try and go off game two and fail because you have a couple of pieces of destruction, and all of a sudden they have 3 minutes to try and put together in game three.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I don't know that we could ever implement such a thing in paper.
You can't. It's not possible.
But it's unfortunate because I think it is a really, really good thing for, you know, for the balance of the game.
Agreed.
And primarily because it allows you to not have to deal with someone just slow playing and, you know, taking 3.5 minutes to shuffle and then you go to time. You don't have that feel bad of having those draws. So
yeah, there's always a definitive winner.
Yeah. But I would bet that and I kind of mentioned this earlier, but I would say that affects the metagame as well because there are decks that just can't win fast. Man, if I'm watching someone play mono blue turns and I'm just rolling my eyes over there in paper, thinking, wow, I hope that I, like, you know, you just have to concede at a certain point so you have enough time to just win the next few matches. But online, I'm thinking, yeah, man, you're down to 2.5 minutes. Go ahead. Go ahead and combo out on me.
Yeah.
So, all right. Anything else you want to speak to Moto on?
No, Moto's great, man. I love it.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I think the pros far outweigh the cons in this situation. I'm disappointed that we can't have any sort of version of the chess timer in paper. I wish there was an option for that. I just don't see it happening. Yeah. I don't think it's within.
Dude, it's just Rome. Moto has the ultimate pro, which is I can sit around in my boxers and play Magic.
Yeah.
Like, what bigger pro do you want?
Yeah, man. I don't know if you ever listened to Spike Feed, but I love Spike Feed. I give them a little shout.
I have.
Curtis is one of the hosts on Spike Feed. Brought up a really good point, and that was that the demographic that plays Magic is aging out of the Fridays being available. He said something like, "Yeah, this game has kind of grown with us, and you know, like a lot of the players, you know, the average age of a player when you go to a big tournament is probably like mid to late 20s now, right?"
Yeah.
Game's about 25 years old. Obviously, these players didn't start playing when they're 1 year old. But, you know, you pick it up in middle school when the game's rolling on. And a lot of us have been playing since that time. We've been playing all our lives. And so as the game gets older, the player base gets older. And we really aren't drawing a lot of younger players because, you know, the game's expensive. You know, people are too competitive for them. And, you know, there's that kitchen table crowd. But the players that are going to be going to those events, they can't make it out every Friday night like we used to be able to do. We've got commitments.
Kids, girlfriends.
Kids, girlfriends.
I'll say it because you're too scared to.
Yeah, man. I think that's a huge factor. You
own it. Jesus Christ.
Yeah. It's exactly. I mean, that's exactly what I'm talking about, though. The ability to go out on a Friday. I don't know the last time I went to a Friday night Magic. I would love to. It's just not happening. So being able to have that experience in just 2 hours online, oh, it's great.
Yeah, like 8 o'clock on a Monday. Monday stuff anyways, absolutely.
Yeah, when I'm watching the Packers get their asses kicked tonight, that's what I'll be doing.
Hey, enjoy that shit, man. All I know is Jaguars still blow donkey balls, and I won my fantasy football matchups. That's all that matters.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah, like literally the Jaguars are so bad that I just care about winning my fantasy football matchup every week now. Okay. It's just they're a little unwatchable.
Why do you care about the Jaguars? Is that your team?
Yeah, that's my favorite team.
Oh, really? Yeah. That's unfortunate, Daryl. You've been on a long long streak of the Jaguars are so bad that I can't watch football anymore.
They're literal unwatchable, man. It's so horrible. It's so depressing how unwatchable they are.
Where did that come from? I thought you're from Indiana.
I am from Indiana, but I never really got into the Colts when I was younger. I really liked teams that ran the ball and played defense because I thought those were the exciting parts of football.
Okay.
And the Colts did not do that good. But the Jaguars, when I was younger, were very good at it. And now they just are not. They are not.
And you were rolling the dice. You were playing the football equity lottery there, and it didn't pay off, friend.
I did not win the football equity lottery on this one. You are 100% correct.
No, you could pick any team in the league. You could have picked the Patriots, who have been good historically, and I could have also picked the
Cleveland Football Browns, which would have been disappointing. I'm so glad I did that one.
Well, we're a magic podcast. Let's get back to it.
Yeah, sometimes we have to digress, man. We're humans and we like to talk about stuff. Whatever.
That is a good point.
If the viewers don't like it, I can tell them to go jump off a cliff. I was going to say something more explicative, but
we're not Brainstorm Breweries, so we won't do that.
I couldn't remember if we had the explicit tag every week anyway, so I just decided to be more reserved.
All right. So we got, like, 1.5 more things to cover, and we got about 20 minutes. I think we can get these both done, but I apologize if we don't get into modern. Do the short one first?
Yeah, the mill one should be short.
All right, cool. So here's the thing that Saffron Olive posted on his website recently, and that is this mono blue mill deck.
So here's the thing. Nobody likes mill, so I don't know why we're talking about this. Proceed.
That's a good point to make, and that's exactly why we're talking about this, because I think this is a real threat out there for this random deck that's just going to take you down and catch you with your pants down.
I definitely have gotten beaten by this Esper Mill deck.
It's scary. I've exclusively gotten beaten by this Esper Mill deck.
I have an 0-2 record against this Esper Mill deck. I'm not very happy about it.
Well, okay, so here's the thing. This Mucha Brew that he posted is mono blue mill. It looks like hot garbage. It's bad. It plays a bunch of draft chaff. And apparently someone won in IQ with this deck, is impressive to me.
He only has one in $6 the shore in the 75. Charge. How did he win?
Yeah, he has no mind break traps. I mean, this is like Tome Scour, Mind Sculpt, Psychic Spiral. Come on, man. Traumatizes in this deck.
Please, why? Oh my god.
So we don't need to talk about that too much, but I brought it up because it's a thing. You know, mill's a thing, and this blue black mill, and now I'm seeing more of this blue black white mill to splash for Path to Exile, is something that is really tough to deal with unless you're prepared and have experience with it. If you do not respect Hedron Crab, that thing will single-handedly kill you with the help of Polluted Delta and Misty Rainforest and any blue fetch land. That's freaking scary.
All of these things are factual.
Now, they're running Manic Scribe, too, which is a new card.
That card is freaking annoying. Shadows? I freaking hate that.
One in a blue for a 0/3 human wizard. When it enters the battlefield, each opponent puts the top three cards of his or her library into his or her graveyard. Delirium at the beginning of each opponent's upkeep. If there are three or four or more, if there are four or more card types in your graveyard, that player does the same thing. Puts the top three, mills three. I don't know that card's like awesome, but it's certainly making its way into these decks as like a two of, just as another creature, because you really are going to be boarding out a lot of your removal because it's just bad against like 90% of the deck. But you've got to keep it in for Hedron Crab. You got to respect that Hedron Crab. And maybe that's just like a bolt or something that could go to the dome otherwise. Yeah. I don't know.
Tilting.
But Mesmeric Orb is a factor here. They drop a Mesmeric Orb, you untap like 8 times.
I literally was playing Lost Legacy in the sideboard of my Narset deck until I played against this exact deck, and it made me just take the card immediately out of my sideboard. Because I casted it with the express desire to name Ms. Maricor before you played it and couldn't because you can't name artifacts of Lost Legacy.
Oh, shoot. Yeah, you can't.
And he had a Mesmeric Orb in his hand.
Yeah, you blew it, Daryl.
At first, I thought that the card was bugged because I couldn't name Mesmeric Orb.
Uh-huh.
And then I read it again, and I was just like, this card is garbage!
Yeah. Surgical Extraction can deal with Mesmeric Orb because it's going to be a million zone, but it's probably already in play at the time that it happens. Sorry.
Nope.
It's hard to race that. You just got to have artifact removal for it.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know what this deck is really bad against, and I'm confused as to whether or not it's good or bad against Dredge, because Dredge certainly helps it along, but it certainly helps Dredge along.
Right?
I don't know, man. I think that Dredge gets itself down to 30 cards in deck pretty quickly. If you just let it do its thing and hold a handful of mill cards, I think you can finish them off pretty fast.
It's got to be bad against Burn, though, right?
It's got to be bad against Burn, yep. I don't know. It's like kind of on the same pace as Burn, honestly.
Not really.
It's running Crypt Incursion, which is pretty great against Burn.
That could definitely be a thing.
This deck is fast.
Not really, because Burn doesn't have any creatures. So if you just like happen to hit like spells and lands,
oh, Burn's got lots of creatures. Yeah, all it has to have is two creatures in its graveyard for Crypt Incursion to be worthwhile. It's three life per.
Oh, Jesus. That's way more life than I thought it was.
Yeah.
Oh, all right. Moving on.
But also...
What does your deck lose to?
That's what I'm saying, man. I think that, like, what, Emrakul deck, that doesn't even work because they mill more than one at a time. I don't know what this deck loses to. That's what I'm confused about. That's why I don't think... That's why I'm confused as to why it's not a bigger factor in the meta.
I don't know.
It probably loses to Leyline. They can't target you.
White Leyline?
Leyline of the... What is it? Sanctity? Leyline of Sanctity. But you don't see a lot of people playing that right now.
Yeah, like, I mean, but to be fair, he has two answers to Leyline of Sanctity, and that's it.
Yeah.
Two Echoing Truth. Like, you are actually stone cold doing Leyline.
Yep. That's really good against Tron. I found that out the hard way. You wouldn't think it is, but it's great against Tron. Because Tron always searches its deck. Mindbreak Trap is just brutal. It's insane.
Oh, yeah. Mindbreak Trap is fair. You mean Archive Trap?
Archive Trap, yeah. Thank you. Archive Trap is brutal. Surgical Extraction main deck is brutal. In almost every matchup.
Anytime you get the Surgical Extraction Tron lands, it's hilariously good.
Yeah. So you can't race it, and then once Tron like actually can stabilize, there's nothing left in its deck to tutor out, you know, as far as threats go. It's really tough. But yeah, it's definitely an interesting deck. Be aware. Archive Trap, Raking and Entering, Crypt Incursion, Glimpse the Unthinkable, Mind Funeral is a big killer. You've got to really be on the lookout for those 3-mana sorceries to just like end the game. You know, keep your mana leak mana untapped. Path to Exile, Surgical Extraction, Thought Scour, Visions of Beyond in this one. That's the one that is basically an Ancestral Recall when a player has 20 or more cards in the graveyard. That happens quite often in this deck, if you can imagine. But Ensnaring Bridge is a big factor in these guys, too. So if you're not looking out for that, then, you know, you just get stuck and you just watch your deck be placed in your graveyard.
Yeah, into the other pile. Yep. All right, I've had enough of this deck. I don't want to talk about it. Can we go to the actual thing?
Yeah, let's go to the actual thing. That's enough of that deck. So the last thing we want to cover here is, since we're talking about this high-level competitive play, I would make the argument that the two most important decision-making processes in big tournaments are sideboarding and mulliganing. And the difference in like the play level of a lot of like you know, actively competitive players is big but not huge. And I think that the difference in the mulliganing decisions is really the biggest factor in, you know, who's successful in this game and not.
Absolutely.
And so I want to up the stakes a little bit. We're going to play a little Would You Mullet, And this is going to be a new segment that we're going to try here.
I will never mullet, by the way. I don't want to look like that.
So would you mullet? I'm going to give you a deck. We're going to assume that each of these is game one.
Can I get a stock list so that I know what the rest of my deck looks like?
Yeah, you can pull up a stock list.
All right. I just want to know if I can go grab a stock list.
Okay, sure.
Okay. So give me a minute. I'm going to go get those.
Yeah. We're going to start with green-based Tron, and typically the Tron du jour is green-white Tron. And I'm picking these because these are the ones I know best right now.
Sure. So the Tron du jour is green-white Tron. So let me see if I can find. Where's a Tron? Let's see if I can just find a random. That is not a Tron.
And to make things even more interesting.
I have acquired a Tron list. You may proceed.
Good. To make things even more interesting, we're going to assume that we've already mulliganed one time. Our first hand was just Stone Cold Unplayable. We had mulled down to six because I think those are when our decisions become even more complicated. And a factor in that now, too, is that scry that you get when you keep your maul. So you can get a little bit more information. Let's say that we're on the play.
Sure.
Okay, you're on the play. Game one. You mulled to six already. You're going to scry. Keep that in mind. You're playing green-based Tron. You don't know what you're playing against. It's game one, right? So you've got a Razor Ridge Thicket. You've got a Chromatic Star, an Ancient Stirrings, an Expedition Map, a Karn, and an Ugin.
So, in game one, I'm almost apt to say that this hand is, stone unplayable.
Yeah.
Because, you do have all the pieces to, get you going. You have Thicket and the Stirrings to try and find another land.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't have any Tron pieces, which makes it kind of hard for me to want to keep this hand. Because, your first payoff card you could play on turn four if you Stirrings into a piece and then draw in one of your other two draw steps the other piece. And, you go, turn one Stirrings into a piece, turn two land, map, star. That first piece you had. And so turn three, you draw and you have to hope to hit a piece. Because you don't want to be in the position of fetch a piece and then draw the same piece with your map.
Yeah.
And then you have two draws to hit that second piece. So, it's very on the borderline of unkeepable or, completely reasonable. It sits right in the middle of that line for me.
Yeah, this is a particularly tough one, but this is a pretty common draw with Tron. These are a lot of the decisions you have to make when you're playing these kinds of decks.
So that's the thing of not...
You get a lot of gas.
That's the thing of not playing this deck that I don't know very well. I don't play these green-based Tron decks that are just trying to, 1-2-7.
Sure.
I'm used to playing, blue-white Tron, where, if I don't have a Tron piece in my opening hand, but I have a bunch of colored mana,
mm-hmm.
that's completely fine, because all I'm going to do is just, play my colored mana spells, use my colored spells to interact with my opponent, and then, eventually I'll put Tron together and beat them. But, when you're just trying to go 1-2-7, I think it's much less acceptable to have turn one no Tron man.
Sure. Yeah,
so
I would agree. I think this is. This is best case scenario is a 2-3-4 scenario here, or 2-3-7, I should say.
2-3-8, really, because you have to play
2-3-8. So then you can potentially drop the Ugin on 8. But let me just read this hand one more time. It's been a little while, just to clarify. I know it's too tough to visualize. Razor Ridge Thicket. You got one land in your hand.
Okay, yep.
You've got three fixing pieces, Chromatic Star, Ancient Stirrings, and Expedition Map. You know, more or less. Some of them can sort of pseudo-fix in that they draw a card and give you some mana.
Sure.
Karn and Ugin are your big plays now. That's on 7 and 8. So, assuming things go as planned, you can get to those, but any kind of disruption that your opponent's going to play is going to cripple you. Because both of those both of those fold to mana leak. Whereas a lot of your other big drops, like Worldbreaker, for example, it gets countered and it still has an effect. So
if you're on the play, this hand is keepable. If you're on the draw, I don't think you can keep this I think you have to keep it because of the reason I'm getting ready to give you, even though it makes the hand unplayable. If your opponent just goes turn one, swamp Inquisition, and takes your Ancient Stirrings,
yep.
your hand is just garbage.
Yeah, exactly.
It's so bad. But if your opponent doesn't land Inquisition Ancient Stirrings, you then you're fine.
Well, remember that you're going to scry, and I don't know that should play in that heavily to this decision, but you've got to consider it. In best case scenario, you're going to scry, and you're going to see one of your Urza-Tron lands on top of your deck. That's a one.
I mean, you hope.
You got 12 hits in your deck, right?
Yeah.
So you don't see one. Hold you can scry it to Let the bottom. You can hope to draw the next one.
Let me get out the hypergeometric calculation machine real quick to All give right. you...
You're looking for your odds. You got 12 yeah. and 54.
But it's different because you're... I guess it's not because you're just doing it twice. But it's more hypergeometric. It's a harder hypergeometric if you do it twice.
Oh, because of the scry?
Yeah. Because sure. you're looking... So you technically can look at up to two cards. So population size is 54. There are 12 successes. Whoops. There are 12 successes. Sample size 2. Looking for at least one. I'm doing the mathematics here. So for the probability for this to be greater than or equal to 1, 39% of the time.
That's pretty high.
39% of the time, you get at least one.
Yeah, that's great.
So 60% of the time, you get boned.
I think I like those odds. With this hand, you've got Ancient Stirrings. You've got Expedition Map. You've got Chromatic Star.
If you keep the Ancient Stirrings, your probability goes up way higher.
Yeah, but you're on the play. You're going to be playing it first.
Oh, yeah, you're on the play. This is great. Then with Ancient Stirrings plus no draw step, you have 6 looks for a Tron piece. You have a 79% probability.
Sure.
That's great. And so if, you know, you're looking at your 79% probability to find the land. And if you find the land on that first draw, you don't even play Ancient Stirrings. You just play like a star or a map.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but yeah, if you're locked into having Ancient Stirrings because you don't find a land, you know, for the scry plus the Ancient Stirrings, you're 79%.
Now, here's where this is concerning, though, because if your game plan is to drop a Karn, you know, you're going to be dropping Karn as early as turn 4 in this situation, based on the fact that, you know, you can't play it.
Yeah.
You're not going to be playing in this land.
Take
your
turn off.
So in a lot of matchups, they're going to have, you know, 1 to 2 aggressive creatures on the board before turn 4. Karn comes out, he goes down to 3, and
kills
one of the things, he dies to the next thing. So the only good news about that is you've got Ugin, and Ugin comes down on the same turn. So Ugin can deal with the masses. So you've got two choices here. You can deal with wide, and you can deal with tall and Ugin and Karn.
Yeah.
So that's pretty encouraging.
I think actually the key to the hand is, you know, if we're looking at, we just need another Tron land to get going.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. And to be willing to keep this hand, I think the key to this hand then is the fact that you have Karn in Ugin. If you only have Karn, then it would be unkeepable. I think the key is actually just Ugin. Because you have Ugin that you can play on curve if you hit all 3 Tron pieces, like that I think makes the hand keepable. If you just had Karn, I would be less inclined to keep it.
Right. And, you know, last consideration here, you have to consider the alternative, and that is to mull down to 5. This is not a deck that mulls particularly well. Fewer cards, you're just inquisitioning yourself, you know, because what they're probably going to strip is one of those pieces that helps you set up. If you are drawing one fewer card, odds are that you're going to be losing either a land or a setup piece. And if not, you're going to be losing some gas and with what to do with it. So I'm keeping this hand all day. I'm pooping my pants about it, but it's only game 1, and I'm going to hope that I draw better next game and game after.
Yeah, I mean, the Ancient Stirrings makes this keepable.
Yep.
Now, Ancient Stirrings plus 2 game is what makes this hand function.
Quick question for you. Imagine Razor Ridge Thicket is an Urza-Tron land. How much better does it get?
Or worse? I'm less excited about the hand.
You've got
Chromatic
Star.
Because then my Ancient Stirrings is actually susceptible to Inquisition.
Yeah.
So I'm not necessarily guaranteed to find the second piece.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, I'm locked – because then I could be stuck on, you know, 2 looks at another land. And, with the math changes hugely there. You know, if you look at, you know, there are 19 lands in that deck, I think, after you play the first one. You know, your percentage to find another land in that is much, much lower. Is, you know, we go from 80% to find the next land we need to 58%.
Right.
So, I mean, that's a huge, huge change.
It's definitely a riskier hand, but it could pay off bigger.
Correct. You could play a card on turn 3 and prevent your opponent from playing the game.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's go on to the next deck here. And again, I've picked these two because these are the ones I'm familiar with. I can't really speak to anything else, you know, with the same level of information right now. Grixis Delver, obviously, is my second one. So this is another six-card hand. We're on the play. You've mauled once. You're going to scry. You have zero lands in this hand. You've got a Gitaxian Probe, a Bolt, a Delver, a Serum Visions, a Thought Scour, and a Tassigar.
These are the hands you sign up for to play Grixis Delver.
These are. You are 19.
Like, I would never mulligan this hand in a billion years. You have an extra look. So you have two looks at a land. So you're basically in the same exact position you are with the clock. Literally, I think, with the math I just did. Let me go back to my mathematics machine here. Yeah, you said there are 19 lands in this deck?
Yep, 19 lands.
It's literally the exact same math I just did for the Tron deck. I assume there were lands in the Tron deck before. But, you know, you're looking at a 54 population with 19 successes. You get potentially two looks up to, and you need to hit one. The probability that X is greater than or equal to 1 is 58%. So you're 58% to get there, so you're coin flipping on whether or not you get to play this match of Magic.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you don't feel comfortable with that, you know, when you mulligan, don't sign up to play this deck. Yeah, these are the hands you sign up for.
Yeah, exactly. It's certainly scary, but you've got six cards you can play, and potentially the seventh card you can play off the back of Thought Scour and a fetch land pretty consistently on turn two in that situation. This is a great hand, honestly. I think this is like the hand that you want to see on a Malda 6.
Okay,
it would actually look better with a land.
I was going to say, would you trade the Gitaxian Probe for a fetch land?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
But I wouldn't trade that Gitaxian Probe for a swamp. I wouldn't trade that Gitaxian Probe for a mountain.
So is there one of these cards that you would trade for a basic land? In the six-card hand.
If
like
it's
that,
a basic island, all day I would trade for a basic island because I got Serum Vision, I got Thought Scour. But like I said, swamp and mountain is a lot less appealing, particularly swamp. You can't do a whole lot with that.
Bolt. Okay. That's a
mountain you can buy a turn, you can survive a little longer. But
swamp
just
so exciting.
Now this deck can potentially win if it misses a land drop on turn one and draws it the second turn. It's not great, and it slows you down, but there's a lot you can do with one mana and two mana on this deck.
If we want to press out that to three to if you're willing to miss that land drop, now you're looking at a 73% chance to hit a land.
Okay. So odds are good.
So I mean the odds are not necessarily great, but they exist.
Yeah. All right, Daryl, why don't you give us a scenario in a deck that you are currently playing?
So I got this Narset control deck I've been playing.
Yeah.
In fact, I played 75 matches in the past 2 weeks. I feel pretty comfortable playing the deck. So we move into six, turn one on the play. Colonnade, Polluted Delta, Island, Narset, Swamp, Path.
All right, so kind of a reverse situation. Now we're flooded, right?
Yeah, we've got a bunch of lands, a four drop that we can cast if we get there, and a Path to Exile.
Yeah. No, Narset doesn't do a whole hell of a lot on her own. She can scry and draw, can't she? Is that one of her functions?
It's look at the top card. If it's a non-creature, non-land, put it in your hand.
Okay.
You reveal it and put it in your hand. If it's not, it stays on top of your deck.
Now, knowing my luck, I'd be looking at lands every time I activate that in this situation, but...
You do. It's a coin flip with Narset. Like, literally, there's 27 hits or misses and 31 or 33 hits. So if you keep a hand and you play over the course of the game, you're, like, coin flipping for extra cards in the middle of the game.
I guess the good news is you flood out and you've got a Colonnade, so you've got some, like... aggression, or in this situation, probably more likely, like, if you need it, an emergency blocker. But
okay,
you got to draw something, right? I mean, what is this deck running? Do you have, like, some... as far as draw, do you have Esper Charm? I assume you have Esper Charm.
Three Serum Visions, four Esper Charm.
No visions?
No Ancestral. Three Serum Visions.
Okay.
Yeah. You cannot rebound Ancestral Visions.
Oh, I see. Yep. Correct. Serum Visions, like, in a control deck, Mana Flood situation, is so much more valuable. That's a great top deck, version of these, like, one-mana cantrip cards.
Yeah, I agree.
you know, like in those situations, like I wouldn't trade that for Brainstorm in Modern, you know.
I would immediately trade that card. I would immediately trade Serum Agent for Brainstorm, especially since this hand has a fetch land.
In a top deck situation, that's what I'm saying though. It's like late game, you flood it out. You don't have any other gas. Yeah, I'd want to Serum Agent over Brainstorm.
I would agree. Serum Agent over Brainstorm is great. Each has their time to shine. This hand is one of those that like you're kind of like eggs in the basket of like play Colony on turn one and then like untap on turn two and play like Half Path to Exile up and then play your Polluted Delta with the intention of probably fetching a Godless Shrine to like take no damage from your mana base.
Yep.
And then it's kind of very draw dependent. If it's one of those things that if that Path to Exile doesn't do anything, you mulligan to five and you just lose the game, basically. Because your first play is a turn four Narset, which if your combo opponent has a slow hand and isn't killing you, you can ult it and then they lose. Unless they're like Hand Company or something like that. Yeah. But otherwise, if they have like a mediocre hand that they turn five you lose. So like, you have no discard, you have no, you know, no Esper Charm to catch up, no Seer Visions to scry. So, like, you have the lands to cast the spells that you have, and probably any of the spells that you would cast for the rest of the game. But you do kind of stumble in two ways, which is if you draw more creature removal, it may be terrible, and if you draw more lands, it may be terrible. And there are some really bad draws in that deck that are, like, you know, on turn two with this hand, I don't want to draw Batterstorm.
Right, right.
I don't want to draw Gideon Jura. I don't want to draw, you know, Supreme Verdict. That might be a card, the only card I want to draw. Because if my opponent is playing creatures, they'll have, like, three guys on play and you'll get to kill them all. And you can save your path.
What's our best case scenario here? Do you want Serum Visions? Do you want Lingering Souls? What?
I mean, your best case scenario here is discard spells, Serum Visions, Esper Charm, Lingering Souls.
Okay.
The order in which I probably want them is discard spell 1, Lingering Souls 2, Esper Charm 3, Serum Visions 4.
Yeah, okay.
And Serum Visions the Scry is really useful, but I would rather just have it a little bit later. If I'm going to draw this game, I wouldn't want to draw it immediately out the gate because, like, you don't want to play it on turn 2 because you're going to break this fetch land. So, like, you're locking yourself into breaking fetch. And you want to get that Godless Shrine because you want to have multiple black open for whatever various black spells you want to cast, but your deck is mostly white. So really, you just want to get another white source with this Polluted Delta. Because you have two Gideon Jura, three Supreme Verdict, and a Gideon Outlands in the car, all of which cost double white that you want to cast.
Mm-hmm.
So you're like locking yourself into getting a Godless Shrine with this, so or a Hollowed Fountain, but you're just locked into getting a white land that is a shock because it's a Polluted Delta. So, like, you have to break your Polluted Delta and expose whether or not you have Path to Exile or a discard spell by, like, protecting your Scry and breaking your fetch land early. So I don't want Serum Reserve. It's kind of the concept there. Because it, like, messes with your mana base.
Right, right.
Like, it might force you to take damage on turn 3 or 4 if you go, like, Colonnade into Islands, Serum Visions, Scry, leave on top, have Path up, and then, like, turn 3, you want to play like Lingering Souls or Esper Charm, you can go swamp, you know, spell. But then turn 4, if you haven't drawn on the land, which is the hope, you have to, if it's a double white spell like a Gideon Islands in the car or Supreme Verdict, you have to take 2 to get that spell cast.
Well, you could fetch a swamp with the Polluted Delta on turn 2, couldn't you?
You have the swamp in your hand.
Oh, there's only one in the deck.
Yeah. There's two plains, one island, two plains, two island, one swamp.
All right. Okay.
So you have. You also just need two white sources to cast your double white spells.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So it's very tricky as to how you want the beginning of the game to play out. And I think Serum Visions is the card you're like least happy to draw because it exposes your opening plans for your beginning turns.
Yeah. Well, that's a decision that, I mean, this is a great example of how you have to really know how this deck operates and how, you know, you have to be familiar with the inclusions in the deck.
Yeah, that's why I sent you the list so that you can look at it and see.
Yeah, I just pulled it up finally. No, I forgot that.
What's your, what you were dealing with in game one as a main deck.
But that's tough. Sequencing your mana is tough. And this is a pretty great textbook example of that. Especially when the unknowns are in, you know, your top deck. So you don't know what you're going to draw, but you've really got to set yourself up for, you know, any possibility in the deck. Because you don't want to get stuck without two white for, like, a supreme verdict, you know, in a situation like this. Because that might be, like, your only out in a lot of games.
Yeah. So supreme verdict might be the bingo, in all honesty. You might just, like, cast that supreme verdict, and then the game, like, if you get to hold your path to exile for their main land because you have a supreme verdict all of a sudden... The game goes from unwinnable to unlosable because you supreme them and you have a path for the follow-up threat, and then you can draw Lingering Souls or you have a Narset in your hand to stabilize to start drawing cards and locking out any spells they may be playing. Yeah. And then sort of stable and pull you towards Gideon's or Lingering Souls or Batterskull and sort of stabilize from there.
No, looking at this list, I really hope that you are aware that you need double white because it's like a shit ton of it in here. Gideon Jorah and Gideon Alive Zendikar.
Yeah.
You need a lot of white.
Yeah, if you sign up playing this deck, you know that you're like a white-black deck splashing blue.
Yep.
Instead of a blue-white deck splashing black. So that's why you're more apt to get those godless shrines for the Holocron. Yeah.
Cool, man. Well, I think this is a fun segment. I think we should keep doing this. We can do, obviously some more different styles of decks.
I'll have to get a vintage one for us because no one will know what's happening.
Oh, God, yeah. I wouldn't have anything to offer to that.
Dude, you just get to look at the deck and figure out, like, can you kill them on turn one? Like, it'll be a sideboarded game.
No, I'd look at the deck and try to figure out what the hell you're trying to do with it.
Oh, dude, the deck is very obvious, the one I played. It casts Tendrils of Agony.
Oh, yeah, we talked about that last week, or 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, we're just doing that.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll just pull up a game two. I'll take it easy on you, Corey. I'll say, all right, you're playing game two against the non-blue deck. Here's what you got. Figure it out.
So, hey, what's the verdict on this? We keep that hand, yeah, that Esper Control hand?
The hand is keepable, but it's on the it's like the green-white Tron hand.
Yeah.
It's on the very bottom of the range of hands I want to keep.
We need a definitive, though, because we don't know what deck we're playing against. You know, this is game one. Do you keep it or not? You gotta decide, Darryl.
That's what I'm saying. It's on the very bottom range of hands I would keep.
So you do it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I literally said that, and you're like, you didn't say it. And I'm like, eh.
Well, yeah. It sounded like you're kind of hemming and hawing about it. It's on the bottom range. I might not do it.
It's very similar to the hand with green-white Tron.
But, sure, okay.
You know, it took me a while to come around saying I keep that green-white Tron hand. And, like, I know because I don't know the deck, and I know for a fact that I would keep this hand because it casts all my spells. But, like, it's not the most exciting start this deck could have at all. It's just like, eh, all right. I mean, I have a hand. It has lands and some spells. And if I don't draw all lands, I draw spells, I'll probably be able to play Magic.
Yeah.
But like, have to get lucky, so.
All right, so all three we kept. That's one hand with a land with major mana deprivation, but, you know, some consistency and some outs. There's a hand with no lands, but, you know, one would just make it, like, gold.
No gamble, no future.
Yeah. No gamble, no future. That's right. You got to play those.
Then you just got too many lands in the deck.
Yep. Cool. All right. Well, I think that's enough to wrap up on. That was a good solid hour of content there. And I think we got to cover a lot of important stuff in a weekend that involved zero relevant tournaments.
Yeah, I think this is awesome, is that we do get to have we can find these topics that are actually relevant for situations that have, you know, we have a tournament action, because that's, I think, where you get a lot of useful content.
Yeah. Cool. All right, well, we'll catch you next week.
Take it easy, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Card Knock Life is proud to be a part of mtgcast.com. We can be reached at cardknocklifepodcast.com. Or on Twitter at card_knock_life. We're always looking for more help in generating content for the website. And if you'd be interested in doing so, please email at cardknocklifepodcast@gmail.com.